Tonight's program is in partnership with Unbound Edition Press, which has published the three memoirs featured: A and B and Also Nothing by Chris Campagnoni, The Bomb Cloud by Tyler Mills, and Entanglements by Leah Souffrant. Each of these authors and each of their memoirs work across literary genres and across artistic forms, as you may have picked up from the video that was playing as you were entering the auditorium this evening. These authors share some commonalities. They are makers, they are writers, they're visual artists, scholars, teachers, they are experimenters. And they are each widely celebrated for their remarkable achievements. They all happen to live in Brooklyn as well. We are thankful they are here with us in Philadelphia tonight. And in writing their memoirs, they've done something new. Rather than simply capturing and considering key moments in their lives, they have woven together a variety of texts to tell their stories. From literary masterpieces to private journals, from philosophical writings and historical narratives, family recipes, government documents, and personal address books. Their works represent how the acts of reading and writing are intimately woven together, and how both are required for a richer understanding and rendering of the self. Tonight, they're going to read brief passages from their memoirs, engage in discussions across their texts, and then finally take questions from those of you sharing the evening with us. And so without further ado, let's begin. It's my pleasure to introduce Chris Campagnoni, who will be followed by Tyler Mills, and Leah Souffrant will conclude the readings. Chris.
Thank you. Thank you so much for being here. And thank you for Daniel for organizing this and for the hospitality of the Free Library of Philadelphia. In the second part, there is a question. Which stories do I keep in the words I collect? At the beach, I like to let my vision drop and feel the drift as if the tide were really reaching my feet, my ankles and calves, and the long stretch of flesh that is my thighs. When I lie like this, propped up toward the sun, with the glow against the lids of my eyes, I can feel the other bodies on the sand like me, closed and silent, as if our bodies were radiating above the dusted rocks and earth, as if our bodies' silence became a legible language in the middle of the day, in the middle of the week, at the end, the very end of the line. So here is color. So here is mood and sound. So here is the grain of sand in my mouth that a tongue looks for while I am trying to get this out. What I want is a book as pure as talk, to seek out the interruption, to enter into or overhear in passing. I write so I may eavesdrop, so I may drop in or dribble out, almost shamefully. And feeling always comes after, not the flesh itself, but its indeterminate spurts. Everything leaks. News leaks. A faucet leaks. My uniball pen leaks. Bodies leak. A story leaks. Mother speaks of the boy who rubbed his eyes out. So oppressed was he by images. But to be inside a desiring body, to rock in time with its desirous movements, seems almost tectonic, folding increasingly until I become nothing, nothing but nothing, a speck of dust, a blur of shit on the sidewalk, disintegrating inside another body or the other way around, opening me as if a trap door in the floor where I can surrender my desire to self-evacuate. Sometimes it is necessary to forget oneself in order to tell one story, the masquerade of becoming American or naturalization. What a process, I often think, and really try to imagine the miracle. Still thinking how after school on certain afternoons I'd help to shred the old clothes in a ball the size of my shaking fists, the soft clicking of my open lips to keep a beat and forget such hunger. S, looking to see if I was making each thin strip of meat thinner than the one that fell before. Even then, I was, wasn't I? Writing so as to be here twice. She'd passed the bowl down, and I knew when I was done, when my fist was only filled of air. I knew then what could be passed down to anyone. Like any good repetition, I am doing this by heart. If asked about my principles, I'd say I want to draw upon errantry and errancy and the synesthetic flirtation of a post-dated memo. I hear a person can reconstruct a room just by thinking of the other people inside of it. I heard that disembodied voices can sculpt the bodies they belong to. Do you hear a voice when you read silently, when you read to yourself, when you read by yourself? Who else are you with? The loneliness of linguistic singularity, the loneliness of not knowing if we mean the same thing when we say the same thing, when we hear the same thing. The vague sound of chatter, sociality, the public body versus the private self. I like parties like I like a moving image. Any room is a backdrop for an unassisted tour. I move through and take photos in my camera eye. Click, click, click. No one, after all, writes without reading themselves, and no one reads without writing themselves in. And it's your body, your hand here, placed inside mine, which always offers up the best demand and the greatest one, for the text to be more than what it is and less than it will ever be. Like Boris Pasternak, who began his autobiography by stating, "I am not writing my autobiography." Pasternak, who, beginning his autobiography, wrote that the history of a poet requires the collection of unessentials. So in order to tell you about myself, I have to tell you about Ida and Ada and Don Henley, Christopher Newman and Leo DiCaprio and Jacques Derrida. I have to tell you about the people, real or imagined, who are passing through me. This isn't fiction, but sometimes I'd rather tell you about my fantasies, things that are not fact but are not untrue. I like first dates because they permit us the excuse to reinvent ourselves. Sometimes I wonder how far I could go, changing the permutation of muscles contracting across my face, or which leg I like to cross while sitting, and the amount of wonder I want to dole out on my mouth, and when. If unable to locate the transitional moment, assume the existence of a missing link. Whatever is written down, I read out loud, and whatever I hear, I write down. I wanted a more exciting life, so I began keeping a notebook. The notebook could make my life more readable rather than the other way around. In these, as in all scenarios, I don't have a life so much as I have reproduced it. And it's the copying out that matters. In this way, I become nothing but myself, and I needed to imitate myself to better become who I am. Everything I hear, I write down, and everything I write down, I hear twice. I might ask you to go harder or to keep going. As a measure of intensity, I would like to feel this feeling to linger. My ideal reader is the reader who wants to keep playing, who concentrates on pleasure and pursues the text for clues as to its whereabouts. Intertextuality occurs at the moment of modulation. Things break down and blur out to become all things and everything, A and B and also nothing. Thank you.
I loved that, Chris. I loved how you said, "I love parties like I love a moving image." That was really beautiful. My question for you is if you could speak a little bit to the ways that place grounds your meditations on texts. And I just keep thinking about how the body is mediated by language and A and B and almost nothing, and how there are external texts, there are sources, and then there is the landscape created by memory as the persona moves through language, as we experienced just now. And I wondered if there's a moment of your memoir that you, where you really grappled with balancing place as conceived through memory and the mind's emplacement in a source or even sources.
Wow, what a question. Thank you so much. I was speaking at another symposium for a diasporic poetic symposium a few years ago now, actually, right before this book was published, actually, at NYU, and the moderator explained my work or tried to sort of summarize my work by talking about how I never forget about the body, so I like that you brought that in. And I think the body is sort of what, for me, synthesizes all these sort of rotating set pieces that you sort of suggest with your question, because I think just like the people that are mentioned in the book, and I think there was in the excerpt, one person was named S, right? That was for Sophie. Who are only referenced throughout the book with their first initial, place too is like a floating signifier throughout A and B and also nothing. A lot of places are cycled through and referenced, and I feel like when I wrote this book, I was trying to investigate American identity and trying to rewrite American identity with an emphasis on migration and displacement and exile. Both my parents are exiles from vastly different places, Poland and Cuba. And I thought in order to do that, I felt like the text itself has to wander. There's a moment in the text where I actually write, this text wants to wander. And there's a moment, too, in the beginning where I say, even if this occurred in the past, I would have used the present tense. So there's this constant multiplicity and displacement of time and space. And I don't want to, like, reconcile these discrepancies. I think that's something that I think all of our works, I think, actually encounter and grapple with. And rather than reconcile them, I think I sort of just want to intensify them and actually celebrate them. And so I feel like the body is the moment or the actor that tries to negotiate those disparate times and places. Thank you for that. And please welcome to the stage, Tyler.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you so much, Daniel, for having us, and thank you to the Free Library. I'm going to read two excerpts from my memoir, The Bomb Cloud, and the memoir grapples with a family mystery and the Manhattan Project, and the texts that I've selected touch upon the mystery. My grandfather split up photos of Okinawa and New Mexico in his album, mixing them up. He didn't create a chronological narrative. The commingled, curled photographs of young pilots in military garb, grinning in rows underneath the massive propellers of a B-29, or posing in front of a clapboard shack, or pointing up at the pinup girls distorted over the nose of these death machines, dissolves the what, when, and where of what happened. A stretch of desert where men in uniforms line up and face the distant mountains. Palm trees, the sea, my grandfather in a Jeep. The effect of these juxtapositions, where one place bumps up next to another, one moment in time placed with another, is pastness, a wash of historical imagery in photo after photo. The bombed out cities, pockmarked buildings, ruins, jagged and gray. And then the bomb, with planes in my grandfather's bomb wing fanning around it. Later, after my mother picked all the yellowed, fading photos out of the paper photo corners and put them in a plastic basket for me to look through, and only then, when they were freed from the anti-narrative arrangement, when I sorted them into piles based on the kinds of uniforms, land formations, trees, and equipment, I started to understand. I recognized the New Mexico photos and put them in a pile. I did this with the others, and as I did, I repeated the words, "This is classified," in my mind and asked, but what other than the photo I would expect? Why did he shuffle the rest of the photos, talk about the album as a whole? And then I saw it, the Jeep again. I remembered the story my grandfather told me about getting lost in the White Sands dunes in his Jeep. The numbers on the Jeep, 316BW, confirmed the note in his sister's record. One photo was taken before sunrise, one photo after, before and after, similar poses. The 316 bomb wing, of which Roscoe C. Wilson was the chief of staff. He had chosen the site of the Trinity bomb blast in New Mexico. I lived in New Mexico for 4 years while I was writing this book, and so this next excerpt is set there during a trip I took to Alamogordo. Periphery. I knew that when I passed the easy-to-miss sign for Carrizozo, New Mexico, I'd be approaching the latitudinal zone where the Trinity bomb was detonated on July 16, 1945. Just under a month later, a U.S. pilot dropped an atomic bomb on Hiroshima. Days later, another pilot dropped an atomic bomb on Nagasaki, which my grandfather said he saw in the air. I was there, he insisted. My grandfather told me a group of men from the government interviewed him to be the pilot to drop the bomb. After his death, I discovered a photograph of the atomic cloud spreading out over Nagasaki in his album from the war. When he gave this album to my mother, he told her this was classified. But there is no evidence to back up his story. I lose hours and hours staring into the screen of my laptop and wade into the vapor of his claims, until I find myself staring into buggy websites once maintained by aging veterans. A graveyard of memorabilia sinks deeper and deeper into the network of the internet search engine. I've ordered flight rosters I can get my hands on from interlibrary loan. I do not find his name. He said he was part of the mission, yet I've combed through what USAF records are limitedly available in the National Archives online database and keep finding nothing. Because of his aunt's address book, I know he trained as a pilot in Alamogordo, New Mexico, before shipping out to the Pacific Theater. Alamogordo is a military town at the edge of the White Sands Missile Range and the powdery dunes of the White Sands National Monument. I drove along the eastern perimeter of the weapons test site as I headed south. I wanted to understand what it might have been like for my grandfather to be stationed so close to the gypsum dunes, so close to where the first atomic bomb would be detonated. I imagined I might learn about his connection to the Manhattan Project and his role in atomic history when I was there. In his other photos in the album, you can see the shadow of the planes on the ground above thatched roofs. There are blank squares in the album where a few of my cousins pried out pictures of my grandfather posing in the cockpit. This was the night of his funeral, but no one touched the picture of the mushroom cloud. My grandfather liked taking photographs in motion from the plane. In one, the runway looks like grooves in snow as the plane touches the ground. The wings are behind you, behind the lens. Why did my great aunt cross out the addresses of her 17-year-old nephew instead of erasing them? She left his whereabouts legible, footprints I tried to follow. For miles and miles, there is nowhere to turn off 54, which is the bare road that hugs the perimeter of the White Sands Missile Range, an active weapons test site. Ground zero for the Trinity Test atomic explosion cannot be seen from your car. When you cross the latitudinal zone, cell service cuts in and out. There, pink and brown land, crusted with ice. Further south, the ice melts. In a press release, the Army claimed that the Trinity bomb drop was an accidental explosion at a storage center for ammunition and weapons. In music, an accidental note creates a change that can be so sudden and strange it alters everything for a moment or for a sustained period of time. Through the swell that takes over the original key, an entirely new system seems to emerge. Then the wave of it all settles back, sometimes. Gadget, the nickname for the first plutonium device ever detonated, became a code name in the lab. When it went off in the Tularosa Basin of the Chihuahua Desert, physicist Kenneth Bainbridge turned to J. Robert Oppenheimer and said, "Now we are all sons of bitches." Thank you.
Thank you, Tyler. So the question I have is sort of about your relationship to the material in terms of the book has your own story of this discovery, your grandfather's story, the received American, the narrative of American history, your personal family story. And I just wonder how you balance the kind of imagined actions of your grandfather, as you were describing just now, with the sense of responsibility for getting the story right, historically or accurate.
I grappled with that so much when writing this book, and I kept thinking about how photographs are kind of windows into the past and windows into time. And so I looked very closely at the stories that the photos told that I had access to, as well as the information they contained, the numbers, the places. I also was living in New Mexico at the time and worked with the New Mexico Photo Archives in Santa Fe. And so I spent a lot of time there. And then I found myself diving into archival texts when I moved to New York and spent a lot of time at the New York Public Library, bringing things up from the vault, scouring military records I could get my hands on, and also thinking too about the primary sources I had access to. And so I kept thinking about imagining as kind of like a lyric space you can create in a text to try to tell the truth without sensationalizing something. And I was really careful never to state something that wasn't true, and I was very careful not to sensationalize something in a way that would enact any kind of further violence in this subject matter. Yeah. Thank you for your question. Now I'd love to invite Leah Souffrant to the podium.
Hi. I'm reading from Entanglements, and I'm just gonna jump right in. If I dwell on these words in an airport, at a table, writing, in an airport awaiting a flight, and at a table next to a man talking to another in a lilting accent, then I write this, entangled with that, with these observations. Where are you reading? What do you see and feel? The work of these entanglements is to acknowledge not the problem of explanation, but its impossibility, at least in any complete sense. Entangled. I still love my adolescent beloveds. We call it crush. The 10-year-old boy in the photo, now dead before he turned 40. I keep strangely grieving young Brian and how he taught me love's power simply by existing in proximity. I see you, blurry by the picnic table on a school field trip, under tall pine trees near the other boys, not quite laughing. Each of us may be loved, even when we don't notice the classmate watching, the camera snapping. On a different field trip, the kids looked at handwritten questions posted on the wall of the museum. Written to the public by young hands in new penmanship, the wall was filled with paper squares, each carrying a question. Some asked about alternative universes. What if had never been born? A corrupt, feared, despised leader, fill in the blank. Some narrowed the imagined worlds to a sharper focus. What if had not been elected? The many speculative questions stood out for their repetition. The one my child liked best and called most different, what if we all loved harder? What if we all loved harder? Your ears perk up to lyrics in countless songs. Love inflects pop songs and rock ballads, songs of loss and songs of desire, and songs of joy, all love songs. Love me tender and rock me all night long, and I can't live without loving you. Not every song, but everywhere you go, its rhythms follow. You wonder how a new love song could be written, yet more emerge every day, cracking open a new way into the difficulty of saying it, love. I look up Brian's obituary. His parents grieve his loss, but say nothing about his life, his work, his death. The obscurity is ominous. Tenderness swells like a wave unexpectedly knocking me under at the beach, crushing. We know it's an ocean, but the push is a surprise. In response to my sincere, I love you, in the home, unprompted by anything but feeling, my child, to test values learned elsewhere, responds, I love you more, and looks expectantly for a response. No, is the only possible answer. It is not possible, not possible to measure, not possible to claim. The child has been out in the world. This is evidence of the corruption. My answer pleases the child enough that the dialogue is repeated until it becomes a game, a test for me to pass or fail every so often. Each time, my saddened eyes intrigue the child a bit more until the responses draw forth her explanations. I know, I get it. It's just funny, you know. I mean, how about an inch? How about a quarter of an inch? A child's excuses for the mean joke of measuring love. Sitting cross-legged on my purple carpet as a young girl, I stared and stared at that photo of Brian under the pine tree in Massachusetts State Park. What once was wilderness, now dotted with picnic tables, I tried to see some signal, but the blurry photo was inert. My attention looking through that camera lens had gone unnoticed on that cloudy field trip, or worse, unwelcome, embarrassing. Kids loving goes unnoticed, embarrassing, and later becomes an embarrassment of riches. Tender memory, unexpected grief, the long threads of love reach in unruly directions. Loving the friend who opened my letter, and loving the friend who never writes back. Loving the boy on the field trip. Loving his parents who keep secrets. Loving. Einstein putting truth in quotation marks begins the discussion of relativity with the unresolvable concerns. What cannot be measured by geometry's methods, what the limits are of how we can measure the world. Einstein asks us to attend to the ways we assume that what we know, the Euclidean geometry measuring a straight line between two points, is relative, is unstable, is a study in how very uncertain our ways of claiming truth are. To know where one object is located, Einstein continues, we must locate it in relation to something else. This is where the measurements begin, to start with a point and extend to another, with numbers marking the in-between. But this is also where we might begin to wobble, to shake, as the certainty of the one is dependent on the other, and we ourselves are in relation to these. The cloud moving in as we find it. Knowing love changes love. Thinking alters love. Thinking love alters what you know of it. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Leah. Yeah, I had a question about your process. I mean, throughout Entanglements, you sort of try to explore and investigate alternatives to explanation and argument, glimpse through sorting, tracing, weaving, and of course, entangling. All of it sort of prompted by what you describe as the rhythm of experience. And so I'm just sort of curious to learn a little bit more about what your process was like in reconstructing or constructing such a porous book into like discrete sections. And like if you know you're sort of picking up and gathering as you go these sort of rhythms of experience, like how do you know when to stop? I think that's always such an important question for writers.
Have I stopped? Right. Yeah, interesting. Well, the way the book is organized, and I hope that a little sense of it was felt in the reading, is through images and observations and reflections, analysis of texts and different sources that come and go and return, so that there is kind of a weaving pattern.
And that extends across the whole arc of the book. The sections I read from are scattered. Then within within the book, there are what you might call chapters. I call them threads. And each one has its kind of focus. So I read largely from the section on attention to loving. There's another cluster on peace, some on history. The book starts with thinking about my family history and the American history of the Salem witch trials, which are entangled in some way, and ends in Pompeii, which, so just to give a sense for the audience who haven't experienced the whole thing. So in a sense, I feel like the whole book isn't divided into discrete sections. I sort of cluster areas of emphasis. And in the writing process, I would just sort of follow an obsession for a while. And as a writer, once I start noticing something, I start seeing it everywhere. And those kind of clusters emerge naturally. But so just organizing them into sort of thematic sections, but the themes also reach across the whole thing. Thanks for the question. Our plan is for us to now chat amongst ourselves for a few minutes, I think. Yeah.
Leah's book has these beautiful footnotes that are like hand designed, which I think is like a lovely way to look at knots or entanglements too, and threads. And you know, and there's visual work in her book, and there's beautiful photos in Chris's book, and I incorporate visual media too. Mm-hmm. So I wondered if maybe we should start by talking a little bit about that. Mm-hmm.
Sure, my mic's not working. I think that's a great question. I was also thinking of like leitmotifs, like you know, Leah, and I think probably every writer in the room, we are paranoid animals, right? I love that when you said when you start noticing something, you start seeing it everywhere. This desire to synthesize all, I think this is also thinking of synthesis, another way to sort of characterize, I think, all of our work as well. And I think for me too, I was struck, especially in this reading, by failure and like what's missing from the archive. Because like I like thinking about like, yes, there's these visual artifacts that are so central to our work, to all three of these books, but also about like, you know, what you mentioned actually, Tyler, in the Q&A, sort of this desire to get the story right, knowing that there's no complete story. And I was like, when I teach to my students an exercise called Texas Caption, something that I also often do myself as a writer, I always tell them to look at holes in the photograph for possible entry points into stories. And I like, I like kind of thinking, because, you know, memory can't touch the thing we are after, right? But we try. History, we know, can't touch the thing, but the body can touch it, even in its failure to touch it, right? It feels something, and that lack is so full, I think. And so, yeah, in a way, I guess I'm responding to your question, Tyler, by thinking about the negative space around these images as possible other entry points into books that are not written, but they are there between the lines in a way.
And that really connects with my book too. There was a moment where I was in the New York Public Library and I had stacks and stacks of books, and it was during kind of like a peak pandemic, so everyone was spread out, we were in our masks, and I just have this sensory memory of just feeling like, just like all I could smell was my mask, and I was feeling claustrophobic, and I had all these books, and I kept poring over them, and I just kept thinking, why am I such a failure? I cannot find his name, I cannot find his name, I cannot find his name. And then there was just something about the absence of his name, of the bomb wing, that made me suddenly have chills, and I realized that it was because it wasn't there. It was never going to be there. And then I did try to request a congressional hearing where I had tracked down, there was a conversation about his bombing, and it in the system it said it was there, but when I tried to pull it up from the vault, a different text came, and then the librarians were very bewildered too. So there became this moment where I felt like in the text itself I encountered gaps, and I felt like in looking at redactions, I was trying to trace the shapes of the shadows or the absences in the text. And I think in a way too, that's why I was working so much with visual media in the book, because one of the really well-recognized images of the atomic the bomb blast in New Mexico, the Trinity bomb, it's almost become so present in our minds, like what does it mean to regard it new? And so I found myself abstracting it and like cutting it away and turning it into a cloud to make myself look at it more closely and to invite like a different kind of contemplation or meditation on it in those works.
I think that's what visual art offers, that kind of attention to what's outside of the words or what's absent. I feel like in those paintings, we see we do see it new. Even the colors that you add are very surprising in really thought-provoking ways, and the sort of suggestion of a narrative that's hinted at in the photos in your book, Chris. It must be working. Yeah, I think what's not there is kind of interesting, and by having gaps in the story, but also gaps on the page, gaps that sort of acknowledge that these narratives aren't going to come together perfectly, that the story isn't going to resolve itself, right, and that these entangling threads are themselves kind of a making of a new understanding, but they're always going to be a little bit incomplete and unresolved, and allowing that to exist in the book is, I feel like, a challenge, but an enticing one. Yeah. Maybe we should take questions from the audience. Do you have questions?
Yep.
Yeah. I think there's a mic coming up.
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah.
Can you hear me? We can hear you. Hang on just one sec. We need it to... I think mine works now.
Yeah, we can jump to the Q&A if everyone's ready for that. Sure. Where was a question? We're going to have a roving mic coming around.
Check, 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 check. 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2. This one should be on in a second. 1, 2, 1, 2.
Did anyone have a question? Okay, I'll come to you.
1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2. One, two, there it is.
Thank you, I didn't expect to be so professional tonight. I got two questions. The first one is for Chris. You mentioned about something, I think it was in your memoir, it was not fact, but not untrue. And I was wondering if you could sort of elaborate on that. And then the other question is for the group, is in terms of influential memoirist writers who you've learned from or you aspire to or who's had some effect on your writing itself. That doesn't necessarily have to be someone who just writes memoirs, but they wrote a memoir during their career. I'm just curious about what the three interests are, or what your three favorites are, if you will.
Thank you so much for that question. That brings me to like another sort of generative prompt that I often work with my students to list 5 things they know to be true and 5 things they know to be not true, and then I ask them to muddle them so that we, when they recite it, we're not sure. And through that innuendo, I think it sort of lends a sort of heretofore unknown intimacy. I like, going back to something I mentioned, I think, in the Q&A, like, I like, you know, not reconciling those discrepancies between true and not true, or even feeling like there is a difference, right, between what we consider to be objective, which, of course, is a lie, right, this fiction of objectivity and documentarian truth, so much of which is actually associated, right, with photographs, but we know that a photograph isn't actually necessarily true, or rather fact. It's associated with fact, though, right, like evidence. And yet we know things as emotional truths, right, to be true, like, you know, in our bodies. In a way, thinking about, like, the memory of the body as a sort of contrast to the narrative of history, and even the memory that, you know, lives on culturally through the public. So I kind of, I think the line that you quoted from, thank you for that reading, I think it kind of speaks to that. And in a way, you know, I wrote a memoir, but I think it's sort of an anti-memoir or a counter-memoir, if you will, because in a way I'm also interested, and I think this also speaks to your question, Tyler, earlier to me, I wonder if it's possible to write a memoir through, like, a sequence of forgetting. And I think I'm interested in that more so than trying to get the story right, necessarily.
I want to jump in on the second question. I would say that for me, I did not conceive of the book as a memoir. So I'm really interested in practices of reading and how reading and thinking and sort of lived experience combine to create a sense of how we know and understand the world through all of these, through sensory experiences and sort of the activity of the mind. So the kind of writers that I think of in terms of a lineage or something like that would be writers who are writing about reading. A lot of entanglements is entangled with writing and reading. And those marks that Tyler mentioned before that I think were on the slides in the marginal notes are actually the ways in which the book is entangled with other texts in the end notes. So that's a preface to say you wanted us to name names, I think. I think of writers like Maggie Nelson, who then writes about Roland Barthes, who of course maybe is going to write about Proust, right? So the writers who are writing about the writers are interesting to me.
I was really inspired by, like, family memoirs, and I was especially memoirs that were looking to uncover kind of a mystery or solve a driving question. So Natasha Trethewey's Memorial Drive was really influential for me, and it's just such a gorgeous, heartbreaking book. And then I also feel a lot of kinship with Jessica Johnson's book Metalwork, about growing up on like mines out in the Western US, and kind of remembering details from her lived experience, but also recreating stories from her mother's letters, because that was a strategy that I found myself using a lot. And then I was really inspired by Camille Dungy's Field Guide to Relative Strangers, which is more of a book in essays rather than like a memoir, but I think that what she does with place and also looking at the West and California in particular is really incredible, and she's also a poet, and so I find my sensibility kind of connecting with hers and the ways that she's using metaphor to tell stories.
I can briefly name some recommendations. Yeah, Roland Barthes, just a second. I think I was super influenced, especially just a single line that I'll paraphrase from an essay he wrote, I think called On Writing Reading. And the conflation is not coincidental, it's intentional. And one of the things he says in that essay, and he's reading Balzac, Sarrazin, and he says, haven't you ever happened to look up while reading? And I was so struck by that line. I felt that I wanted to not write, but film my reading of Henry James's The American, which is his second novel, and Gertrude Stein's The Making of Americans. And I wanted to film my reading of that in slow motion, and that's sort of the idea behind what we got, what we end up getting in the book. The other book that I think I was teaching at the time that I just generally I was sort of attracted to was Edgar Garcia's book called Skins of Columbus. In that book, he starts out by reading the diary of Christopher Columbus every night and then dreaming, hopefully dreaming. Any night that he did dream, he would wake up in the middle of the night and just write his wildly, probably violent, right, dreams down. And it was a sort of subtitled a dream ethnography, and I kind of like thinking about, again, taking a discipline and sort of displacing it, whether through dreams or through, you know, emotional truths that are not necessarily fact.
Other questions? Other questions?
Can we see your jacket, first of all, before I...
Yes.
Yeah, the back of your coat.
Look at how cool this is. Just, it's really cool. Thank you. So, hi. Thank you for being here. I will be very blunt. I am not familiar with any of you. I just really liked the topic, and so wanted to come, and I'm glad I'm here. So, putting that out, knowing that I haven't read anything of any of yours, and I will. These all sound like very different, very personal journeys that you each wrote. So I'm curious about sort of whether the process felt more like it was for yourself as you, I guess, untangled or sorted through some of these things, or how much of the process was about that personal journey and how much of it was about being able to tell something to the world, if they're different for you.
What a great question. I just want to start because mine's very brief. Mine started and in a way ended, and then I kept adding to it, but it started as a class assignment. I was actually in Wayne's class, and the book really starts even like instructional. Like I start off by saying, like, you should consult your pleasure when you read this, and then I say, I want to consult my pleasure as I write this, which were his only instructions to us in a class that I took. It was like the second semester of my PhD. And so I didn't write this with at least like the sort of desire of publication. It was a way to explore, and in a way, a way to decenter a sort of very white Anglo sort of perspective on American identity, particularly by really invoking the canon. Like Gertrude Stein, everyone talks about her, and I don't know how many people read her, but everyone reads Henry James, I think, or they used to. And so I wanted specifically to take these two writers, right, who in a way they kind of overlap, thinking of lineage. Gertrude Stein, I don't know if you're familiar with this long, weird poem called Henry James, and she it's true that they met once before he died, but anyway, so I was sort of trying to commingle timelines and insert my own life onto that image audio track, but it was really a project for me, and I think all my writing is produced at the outset, at least, for pleasure, and then whatever happens after, I think the fun is still to be had, but yeah.
That's interesting. For me, it started out very personally because, you know, my grandfather had this story that he told, and he was very reluctant to give more details, and he had this album that was given to my family, and then he died. So I was deeply grieving him and deeply disturbed by this story, and I felt that I had to find the answers. I felt like I was driven to tell it. It almost became an obsession, and it became almost like my own personal quest, not only to know him and understand his life, but also to kind of connect with something larger and to think about what might be at stake in trying to tell a story that is even now redacted. And the book grapples with that, and it kind of walks readers to the very edge of the possibilities, because, you know, as I was writing, I was thinking about this as a personal journey, but then I found myself marveling at, like, what now about this, when there's so much information available, what even now is still classified, and what's at stake in trying to tell that story. So it was sort of like a deep mix of both things for me.
I feel like the sort of origin of entanglements is a frustration with traditions of argument and the sort of limitations of argument in terms of thinking through how we know and understand the world. And a lot of the book is trying to imagine alternatives to traditional argumentation and to expose the ways that oppression in different ways, in different sort of examples in the book are reinforced by those argumentative traditions. A lot of that was on my mind, and a lot of it comes into the book, but the way that I explored those alternatives is through more of what I guess I would call a poetic approach. As a poet, I think of the world not in an argumentative kind of way, but so as a poet, as a person living in the world, as a woman, and as a reader, so that motivated the book, but it all just got a little mixed up and entangled in the form. But the form is trying to enact a certain way of knowing that I value. Yeah.
We have time for one more question, if anyone has one.
Thank you. I'm bad with the names. The lady on the right, yes.
Leah.
Leah, sorry. I was going to guess that. You mentioned use the word obsessions in your book. I think you started off, the book was about family, and then it kind of morphed into talking about love and the photo of Brian, I think, as well. I guess my question is, how do you come up with different obsessions to write about? Like, what happens when you get stuck? What inspires you to go after something? Because it could have been anything, but what was it about Brian? And how do you come up with different obsessions to talk about?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. The pieces about Brian came to me later in the composition of the book, and I sort of wove them into these other, largely into the parts about love, which includes romantic love and familial love and friendship and other kinds of love, and I think that. I mean, I hope we're all a little obsessed with love sometimes. So I think that that is just something that I'm always interested in. At the end of my reading today, I included some remarks responding to Einstein's theory of relativity. And so I think that's a good example. A lot of the book, the title, as well as other parts of the book, intersect with my interest in theoretical physics as a non-physicist. So I guess my answer, the reason I bring that up is because I think really anything that you're interested in is material, whether it's an old photograph or a memory or a book or just something that you don't understand, that's where I want to go, and a lot of it for me comes through reading things that I don't understand and trying to understand them, rather than leaning into expertise.
I think that might be a good note on which to end. That concludes this portion of this evening's program. But before we adjourn, I just want to remind everyone that copies of all three of the speaker's books are for sale in the lobby, just up the stairs outside of the auditorium. Thank you all so much for coming. But before we conclude, can we have one more round of applause for these terrific speakers?